The Noel Coward Story.
December of this year of grace, 1959, Noel Coward will celebrate his 60th birthday, very probably in his home in Jamaica. Noel Coward, 60. This is an arresting thought to many of us who remember him as he was. We see the silk dressing gown, his early stage livery, and we remember how it was cast like the carapace of a chrysalis. And we recall the emergence from it of a figure suave, mature, witty, and immaculate. The long cigarette holder, the clipped voice with its flow of easy aphorism, sometimes kind, sometimes cruel. And we see Noel Coward as last we saw him in an English professional engagement 5 years ago. A red carnation in the lapel of a black alpaca dinner jacket. A jaunty, almost boyish trot down the curving stairs of London's Café de Paris, where night after night he was giving an astonishing non-stop 45 minutes of sheer professional virtuosity. And that, apart from one London Palladium appearance in Night of 100 Stars for Charity, was the last we saw of him as an entertainer in Britain. It is probably the last we shall ever see of him professionally in Britain. Noel Coward is now domiciled abroad for his own personal reasons. That may be the public's loss, but the public, well, is at a banquet of tears and laughter, of music and of wit, lasting some 40 years. Noel Coward may well feel that he's contributed more than his fair share of pleasure to others, more probably than any other single entertainer of his generation. And from time to time, to turn a lyric of his own, we'll see him again. I can see Noel Coward as I saw him on the last occasion on which I did see him, in his then beloved London home. The home with the huge studio room, a room on two levels with his piano on the higher of them. Cross-legged in an armchair, deceptively relaxed, I don't believe he was, and sipping the driest of dry martinis. Long-holded cigarette, a monogrammed man, kindly, helpful, hostly, professional, a man in his room at the top. And I can hear him say of the bittersweet waltz, quoting as he spoke from his own autobiography, "It is the greatest song hit I've ever had or am ever likely to have. I've heard it played in all parts of the world. Brass bands have blared it, string orchestras have swooned it, barrel organs have ground it out in London squares, and swing bands have tortured it beyond recognition. I am still very fond of it and very, very proud of it." And he added, "Of all the shows I've ever done, it was Bittersweet that gave me the greatest personal pleasure." And it was from Bittersweet that there flowed in a cataract over the footlights the sweet smell and sound of success, with a gusto which one almost felt could have surprised the urbane and sophisticated Coward himself. It was always the late C.B. Cochrane's practice to launch in Manchester before what he called the East Wind of the West End, the long sequence of musical shows with which he and Coward were so closely associated. On that faraway first night of Bittersweet in 1929, a great critic of the theatre who died 2 or 3 years ago, Stephen Williams, had one of his own greatest theatrical experiences. Shortly before he died, he made this recorded recollection of the occasion.
Well, that first night was a great success, and in many ways, a most moving experience. We'd all been, quite mistakenly, under the impression that Noel Coward, this brilliant, arrogant, pyrotechnic young man, was a confirmed cynic, incapable of sentiment. Yet here was a thoroughly sentimental play. Not unduly sentimental, mark you. Wit and intelligence always saved it when it looked like toppling into sentimentality. Cochrane wrote to me a week or two before the production, hoping that I should be at the first night, and he said, "Bittersweet is so different from anything I have attempted before that I'm in a turmoil of excitement. No show I have produced has interested me more than this extraordinary one-man effort. Coward, curse him for the expense, has written a book which calls for an amazing number of parts, of sufficient importance to make it impossible to have them played by chorus people." Now, when a seasoned, hard-bitten showman like Charles Cochrane confesses that he is in turmoil of excitement, then something is bound to happen. It did.
And it certainly did. Still, to go back to the beginning, we have a picture of young Master Coward and a small girl, Miss Gertrude Lawrence, seated in a London to Manchester train. The year is 1912, and they are both of them pupils of Merrim Conti, a pair of Conti kids, on their way to be fairies in a North Country pantomime. They sit in silence until this is characteristically broken by little Miss Lawrence, who offers little Master Coward half of her orange. In that moment, a lifelong friendship, which we all now know as Noel and Gertie, was born. And Noel Coward would surely say that the greatest professional bereavement of his life was the tragic death of Gertrude Lawrence in New York just a year or two ago. But back briefly to the aftermath of this beginning. It's just after the end of the First World War. The young Noel Coward, after spending the major part of his very few months' army service in hospital, and 8 years before that fighting his way onto stages and being kicked off them as a precocious and incompetent young ass, was summoned to an audition before the great team of Grossmith and Lorillard at the Shaftesbury Theatre. The stripling youth had with him the first song he'd ever written. It was called Forbidden Fruit, and though a work of no very great merit, young Mr. Coward believed in it. Grossmith and Lorillard in their stalls chattered away together as Noel Coward began to sing. Halfway through the first verse, he had the swaggering temerity to stop and to address his superiors as follows. "You'll excuse me, gentlemen, but as my time may be just as valuable to me as yours is to you, I can see no further point in my wasting any of either. This is, after all, as we all three understand, an audition." He got that audition, and as a result was airily engaged at a princely salary of £12 a week. He used to appear in the Jerome Kern musical, Oh Boy. 3 weeks later, he was sacked before the first rehearsal by the man brought over from America to produce it. A week later, and he was making his very first cabaret appearance for a guinea or two a week. At the Elysee restaurant twice nightly during dinner and supper, the famous dancers Eileen Dennis and Noel Coward. The Elysee restaurant later became the Café de Paris. And there, 40 years before his farewell to London in that scattered quilted nest of high society to be, at the same time of the night, he was dancing, dancing, dancing on the threshold of the 20s, when that hectic, short-skirted, cigarette-holder jig of society with Noel Coward as its mouthpiece was to go dance crazy.
Dance, dance, dance with the lady you
and this was the Noel Coward of the 20s, the brilliant satirical artist who held up a mirror before a class and a generation to reflect it larger than life. Only in his own 20s, he seemed able to regard his contemporaries with curiously matured attachment and was able to twist the pitiful masquerade of pampered youth into the image of tragedy.
Oh, little rich girl, you're a bewitched girl, better take care. Laughing at danger, virtuous stranger, better beware. The life you lead sets all your nerves a jangle. Your love affairs are in a hopeless tangle. Though you're a child, dear, your life's a wild typhoon. In lives of leisure, the craze for pleasure steadily grows. Cocktails and laughter, but what comes after, nobody knows. You're weaving love into a mad jazz pattern, ruled by pantaloon. Poor little rich girl, don't drop a stitch too soon.
Poor little rich girl, you're a bewitched girl everywhere. Laughing at danger, but you a stranger everywhere. The life you lead is all your nerves are jangled. Your love of feather is a homeless tangle. So you're a child, dear, your life's a wild typhoon. In life's a pleasure, the graceful pleasure steadily grows.
How many remember that this strangely unforgettable little song was written as long ago as 1923 and sung for the first time by Alice Delicia? As a tune, it was a prototype of so many which have come to this strange man Coward, in the corner of a taxi, on a lonely beach, on the deck of a small cargo steamer wallowing through the tropics, and once in Battery Park, New York, where, having staked his all to seek fame and fortune in the United States, he found himself in 1923 a down and out on a wooden bench with a few quarters in his pocket and the deepest and darkest despair in his heart. But to go back, we may imagine that it was when, alone in Battery Park between Wall Street and the Atlantic, without a penny in his pocket, that Noel Coward felt like this.
Blues, 20th century blues, are getting me down. Fools, escape those dreary 20th century blues. Why, if there's a God in the sky, why shouldn't he grin up high? above this prairie, 20th century din. In a strange illusion, chaos and confusion, people seem to lose their way. What is there to strive for, love or keep alive for? Say, hey, hey, call it a day. Lose, nothing to win or to lose. It's getting me down. Fools, escape those dreary 20th century blues.
Now, the actual birth of those blues was to wait until years later, when, as Noel Coward himself might have said, I just couldn't evade cavalcade. I've been told that when Noel Coward wishes a particular service from or a collaboration with somebody, he will caricature himself thuswise. Oh, but you must do it for me, darling. After all, I did write cavalcade. The sweet smell of success in those late 20s and early 30s became an intoxication almost too much to sustain. And the man himself dissolved into emptiness, fled from it all, and found complete seclusion in a borrowed house on a South Sea island and the solitude that finally filled it again. He found something else there, a window which looked out upon a long double line of royal palms leading towards the Pacific Ocean. Behind that window was a room with a view. And that was the place where he conceived the song which so many of us came to know and to love very much later. And that room with a view was where a man alone came to terms once more with the human meaning of success, where the 20th century blues of Battery Park joined hands with the Mirabelle Waltz, and a shape was suddenly made, and he called it Cavalcade. And with Cavalcade, London laughed and London wept and London danced, and London completely took the often hitherto rather suspect Noel Coward to her heart.
The first awakening of spring, the first unfolding of a flower. What is the promise that you bring? What is the secret you are whispering each magic hour? Maybe it is something in the air, for spring is meant for lovers only. Live for the moment and take care, lest love should fly and leave you lonely. But if love should leave you lonely, all my life I have been waiting, dreaming ages through, until today I suddenly discover the face and form of she who is my lover. No more tears and hesitating, fate has sent me you. Time and tide can never sever those whom love has bound forever. Dear lover of my dreams, come to me. All my life I have been waiting, dreaming ages through, until the day I suddenly discover the face and form of she who is my lover. No more tears and hesitating, fate has sent me you. Time and tide can never sever those whom love has bound forever. Dear lover of my dreams, come.
Noel Card was just 32 years of age, and that first night must have appeared an accolade to honor the earlier years of hard work. The 16th night of that long, long run at Drury Lane was probably the greatest experience of Noel Card's whole life. All the chilly and frustrating failures were far away on that 16th night of cavalcade. King George V, Queen Mary, and the whole royal family entered their box. And in his autobiography, Noel Card described the scene like this. The house was crammed to the roof. People sat on the steps and stood in the aisles. I remember trying not to cry, trying not to let the emotional force of the moment prevent me from discovering what it was that was so deeply touching. But I did not succeed. The force was too strong.
It's the soldiers of the Queen, my man, who'd be in my man, who'd see in my man, in the fight for England's glory, man.
Next day, Noel Card sailed for South America to lose himself in Brazil, in Patagonia, and the strange lost lakes of Chile. It would seem that this wandering minstrel has time and time again sailed away from success, but hung around in the face of failure. When Sirocco was roundly declared the flop of the century, he showed himself instantly and daily thereafter for weeks in London's most famous theatrical restaurant. When the somber neuroses of the Vortex were, to his astonishment, practically howled off the stage in Chicago, he wrote dryly upon the wall of his dressing room, Noel Card died here. For a critical view of Noel Card as a straight dramatist, we asked Mr. Alan Dent, dramatic critic of the News Chronicle, to make his personal assessment.
Just two little things I want to say about Noel Card as a playwright. One is that he found himself very early. He was on the stage when he was 12, and he was acting in his own plays at the age of 20. This is very remarkable. The infinitely greater playwright, Bernard Shaw, didn't find himself till he was 40. Then he only found himself through writing 5 unreadable novels. The second thing I want to say is that Noel has never been a really important playwright. I once divided the critics into these 3 categories, the critics, mark you. Those with something to say and an arresting and lively way of saying it. Those with nothing to say and an arresting and lively way of saying it. Those with nothing to say and a dull, vulgar, or dead way of saying it. Now, I could apply this equally to dramatists. And if I do, I have to admit that Noel Card is in the second category, is of those with nothing to say, but with an arresting and lively way of saying it. That is his all-important function in the theatre, and always has been. He said nothing beautifully. He said the trivial things with exquisite wit, unending, enduring, incurable wit. That is his chief quality for me in the theatre, and I hope it goes on for another 20 years.
And thank you, Alan Dent. Now, this is a difficult story to tell. It's not perhaps so much a sequence of events as a medley of moods arising from occasions. The moods of a man who is both cynic and satirist, patriot and romantic. Maybe we get a flavor here and there of, darling, you are marvelous. But there had been more than a few uninhibited raspberries as well. London Calling had been dismissed by one critic who said, among other things, here is a young man who can do some things, but who certainly can't act. No, it's not an easy story to tell. The story of the man who seemed to love equally grill rooms and loneliness and the slow wallowing of tramp steamers. It was indeed a pestilential lady on a small Dutch freighter somewhere between Java and Singapore who had thrust at Noel Card some snapshots of a pudgy adolescent and wrung from him that memorable cri de coeur.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded, and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She's a nice girl. And though her teeth are fairly good, she's not the type I ever would be eager to engage. I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Regarding yours, dear Mrs. Worthington, of Wednesday the 23rd, although your baby may be keen on a stage career, now how can I make it clear that this is not a good idea? For her to hope dear Mrs. Worthington,
is on the face of it absurd. Her personality is not in reality exciting enough, inviting enough for this particular sphere. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. She's a bit of an ugly duckling, you must honestly confess. And the width of her seat would surely defeat her chances of success. It's a loud voice. And though it's not exactly flat, she'll need a little more than that to earn a living wage. On my knees, Mrs. Worthington. Please, Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
Not, as Noel Card once said to me, that I haven't always tended to discourage talentless ladies from going on the stage. How shall we best remember him? For the sparkle of blithe spirit, the deep and touching story of Brief Encounter, the jingoism of Cavalcade, the charm of Conversation Piece?
Don't be afraid, I'll betray you, I'll destroy all the plans you have made. But even your sins, but leave room for my dream, for when all I am, for you is fine. I'll still have something of my own.
Do we best remember him? Surely, when most of us think of that man of the theatre, Noel Card, has not the picture of two balconies, he opened the one and Gertrude Lawrence upon the other, almost instantly spring to mind?
What are you doing here?
I'm on my honeymoon.
Very interesting. So am I.
I hope you're enjoying it.
It hasn't started yet.
Neither is mine.
Are you happy?
Perfectly.
Good.
Are you?
Ecstatically.
What's she like?
Fair. Very pretty. Plays the piano beautifully.
Very comforting.
How's yours?
I'd rather not discuss it.
Oh, well, it doesn't matter. You'll probably come popping out in a minute and I shall see for myself.
Have you known her long?
About 4 months. We met on a house party in Norfolk.
Very flat, Norfolk.
There's no need to be unpleasant.
But was no reflection on her, unless, of course, she made it flatter.
Your voice takes on an acid quality every time you mention her.
I swear I'll never mention her again.
Good. Now keep off yours.
Thank you.
Not at all. That orchestra seems to have a remarkably small repertoire.
Strange how potent cheap music is. Someday I'll find you.
Had a sweet voice, Amanda.
Thank you.
What exactly were you remembering at that moment?
Lots of things.
So was I.
What fools we were to ruin it all. What utter, utter fools.
We were so ridiculously over in love.
Yes. And yet, here we are starting off with two quite different people in love all over again, aren't we? Aren't we?
No.
Yes.
We're not in love all over again, and you know it. Good night, Amanda.
Oh, Elliot, don't leave me. We won't talk about ourselves anymore. Talk about outside things, anything. Only stay with me till I pull myself together.
Very well.
What have you been doing lately, during these last years?
I went around the world, you know, after...
Yes, yes, of course I know. How was it?
The world?
Yes.
Very enjoyable.
China must be very interesting.
Very big, China.
And Japan?
Very small.
Did you eat shark fins and take your shoes off and use chopsticks and everything?
Practically everything.
And India? The burning ghats or ghats or whatever they are and the Taj Mahal. How was the Taj Mahal?
Unbelievable. A sort of dream.
That was the moonlight, I expect. Of course, you saw it in the moonlight.
Yes. Moonlight can be cruelly deceptive.
And it didn't look like a biscuit box, did it? You know, I've always felt that it might.
Darling, I do love you so.
I do hope you met a sacred elephant. They're lint white, I believe, and very, very sweet.
I've never loved anybody else for an instant. And you love me too, don't you? There isn't any doubt about it anywhere, is there?
No. No doubt anywhere.
You're looking very lovely in this damned moonlight, Amanda. Your skin is clear and cool, and your eyes are shining. And you're growing lovelier and lovelier every second as I look at you. You don't hold any mystery for me, darling. Do you mind? There isn't a particle of you that I don't know, remember, and want.
I'm glad, my sweet.
More than any desire in the world, deep down in my deepest heart, I want you back again. Please.
Don't say any more. You're making me cry so dreadfully.
Noel and Gertie, the partnership continued almost unbroken for years. In their professional lives, these two seemed able to live neither with nor sometimes without each other. And in 1936, at the Phoenix Theatre, London, we had this.
Were there, your eyes looked into mine and faltered everywhere. The color of the whole world of the frost began to my universe tumble into. The earth became heaven for you.
And that was from Tonight at 8:30, a sequence of 9 one-act plays which displayed both the partnership at its sparkling best and the extraordinary virtuosity of this man, Noel Coward. And let's remind ourselves once more of the tragical tenderness of shadow play by recalling play, orchestra, play.
Let's have a look.
Now, during these years of the 30s, Coward was working with prodigious intensity, living at the same time right up to the hilt, red carnation, long cigarette holder and all. Now, behind him then, previously, and indeed now, was and is the backroom figure who probably knows more about the one-man Noel Coward workshop than any other person living. For over 30 years as personal secretary and representative, his true amanuensis, Mrs. Lorne Loren, had been right there beside him. And it was Lorne who told me just the other day something about the astonishing speed at which, once the idea is there, Noel Coward writes his material. Private Lives was written in 1 week, Blithe Spirit in 5 days, Hay Fever in 3. Lorne, at Noel Coward's dictation, wrote the script for In Which We Serve in just 18 hours. Early plays were all written in longhand and in ledgers. In the whole of the first and only draft of Private Lives, there appear only 2 minor corrections. The song Matelot was thought up, written and completed in just 90 minutes. And this small enchantment of a song was first sung in Sigh No More at the Piccadilly Theatre, London, in 1945. The last review of Noel Coward's authorship to be seen on the London stage.
Jean Louis Dominique Pierre Bouchon, true to the breed that bore him, answered the call that held him tall, his father's heart before him. Jean Louis Dominique sailed away, farther than love could find him, yet in his brain he heard a strain of love, his true love song. Matelot, where you go, my thoughts go with you. Matelot, when you go down to the sea, as you gaze from afar an evening star, no matter where you roam, you will remember the light through the winter night that guides you safely home. Though you find womankind to be frail, one love cannot fail, my son, till our days are done. Matelot, where you go, my thoughts go with you. Matelot, when you go down to the sea.
Who can help but remember songs like this and others? To a whole generation, many of them are the songs of its yesterday, the songs that generation fell in love to. They are the echo of a sigh and the faraway sweet undertones of 10,000 tables for two, songs set for the sophisticated glow of candlelight. Many of them may be called the songs of the first act, an act in the Noel Coward story which may be said to have ended in 1938 before the curtain rose on war and fell for the last time on operette. Of the 20s and the 30s, the darling of London and New York, had finished. Another one was to arise. London Pride arrived to Noel Coward on a bomb-shattered railway station in the morning rush hour in the spring of 1941. The tune, he said, is based on the old traditional lavender seller's song, Won't You Buy My Sweet Blooming Lavender. This age-old melody was appropriated by the Germans and used as the foundation for Deutschland über alles. I just thought it high time to bring it back to London, where it belonged.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear come to us, and our pride it forever will be. Eliza, see the cost of barrels, there's a double barrel than the fruit farm bar. Oh, Eliza,
little London sparrows,
call them garden market where the costers cry. Cockney feet mark the beat of history, every street is a memory gone. Nothing ever can quite replace the grace of London town.
Now, during the war, Noel Coward, at the request of the government, laid his services at the feet of those serving overseas. He travelled abroad as a pure entertainer, and with him as accompanist went the pianist Norman Hackforth. I asked Mr. Hackforth about those days and about his feelings for Noel Coward, the entertainer and musician.
If I were asked to assess the Noel Coward I know professionally, Noel Coward the composer, lyricist and cabaret performer, I would say simply that he is the greatest one-man entertainer of the century. But I don't think I overestimate him when I say that he is a perfectionist who demands nothing but absolute perfection from all those who work with him. I've seen him reduce actors and actresses to tears for not knowing their lines after at least the first week of rehearsals. And many is the agonized shudder which he has shot at me for allowing a wrong note to intrude in the early workout of a song. But it is all immensely stimulating. Now, Noel can't write a note of music on paper. Not even a simple top-line melody, let alone harmony. Yet he has the most uncanny instinct for musical pattern and harmonic progression. Indeed, I have always felt that to try and restrict this blazing intuitive talent to the theoretical conventions of music would probably have been to destroy it altogether. He can play the piano and compose in three keys, E-flat, B-flat, and, as he puts it, in A-flat if pressed. As Noel's accompanist during the war, I toured South Africa, India and Ceylon and Burma. It was in a train, in fact, between Bloemfontein and Pretoria that he suddenly got the idea for Nina, that terpsichorially recalcitrant lady from Argentina. Now, Nina, I think, is the most brilliantly integrated short exercise in words and music that has ever come out of Noel Coward. Well, we ran up and rehearsed Nina in a day, and fired with enthusiasm, we decided to slap it on before a slap-up high-priced house in a Pretoria theatre the same night. Off we went like this.
Senorita Nina from Argentina knew all the answers. Although her relatives and friends were perfect dancers, she swore she'd never dance a step until she died.
And then Noel dried up. Full stop. He looked at me with a desperate hunted look. I hunted looked back and prompted him with the wrong line. There was a ghastly silence, and then, with a light laugh, he said, "Very well, let's start again." So, rigid with apprehension, we started, and Nina went slap through for the first, and, as you know now, far from the last time.
Nina from Argentina knew all the answers. Although her relatives and friends were perfect dancers, she swore she'd never dance a step until she died. She said, "I've seen too many movies, and all they prove is too idiotic. They all insist that South America's exotic, whereas it couldn't be more boring if it tried." She added firmly that she hated the sound of soft guitars beside a still lagoon. She also positively stated that she could not abide a southern moon. She said with most refreshing candor that she thought Carmen Miranda was subversive propaganda and should rapidly be shot. She said she didn't care a jot if people quoted her or not. She refused to begin the begin when they requested it, and she made an embarrassing scene if anyone suggested it. Or she detested it. though no one ever could be keener than little Nina, on quite a number of very eligible men who did the rumba. When they proposed to her, she simply let them plan. She said that love should be impulsive, but not convulsive, and syncopation had a discouraging effect on procreation, and that she'd rather read a book, and that was that. Senorita Nina from Argentina despised the tango, although she never was the girl to let a man go. She wouldn't sacrifice her principles for sex. She looked with scorn on the gyrations of her relations, who did the conga, and said that if she had to stand it any longer, she'd lose all dignity and wring that silly neck. She said that frankly she got colic from all that over-advertised romantic charm. And then she grew more vitriolic and told them where to put their tropic palms. And she could not refrain from saying that that idiotic swing and those damn guitars playing was an insult to her race. She said she really couldn't pay such international disgrace. She declined to begin the begin, though they besought her to. And in language profane and obscene, she cursed the man who taught her to. She cursed Cole Porter too. From this it's fairly clear that Nina, in her demeanor, was so offensive that when the hatred of her friends grew too intensive, she thought she'd better beat it while she had the chance. After some trial and tribulation, she reached the station and met a sailor who had acquired a wooden leg in Venezuela, and so she married him because he couldn't die. Surely never could have been a more irritating girl than Nina. They never speak in Argentina of this degenerate bambina who had the luck to find romance, but resolutely wouldn't dance. She wouldn't dance. Hola!
Now, Nina is surely the slickest of all the comedy songs which Card has ever written. But Norman Hackforth has himself a deeper respect for one of the smaller ones. And here he is at his piano to echo that distant sigh of, "If you could only come with me." When the war was over, a new Noel Coward, maybe not quite so exuberant, in some ways not quite so sure of himself, launched a new spate of plays, musicals, songs, and films. And to some of these, and especially to the plays, many of the critics have not taken so kindly. Mr. Kenneth Tynan has classed some of them rather rudely as latter-day meanderings with wire-thin plots, somnambulism and funambulism depressingly combined. But that same enfant terrible of drama critics was the first to hail, in a sequence of characteristic verbal fireworks, the birth of the Noel Coward of cabaret, the Noel Coward of the Café de Paris seasons, of Las Vegas, and of New York. He's full to the brim, said Tynan. There are no ashes in his work. A few years ago, the curtain fell on After the Ball, Coward's bold attempt to make a musical out of Oscar Wilde's Lady Windermere's Fan. Although packed with charming tunes and every evidence of hard work, it wasn't a great success. Very soon afterwards, and Coward sailed away from England as his home for what we may assume to be the last time. Shortly before he uprooted himself, he made the following remark to me. I sometimes rather resent being regarded here and there as a rather shrill relic from a rather pointless age. I hope I'm more than that because I still feel reasonably contemporary, very much alive, and there's a lot of the world to be seen yet. A world, though, which has changed for Noel Coward, as for all of us. And maybe we hear an echo of his nostalgia and of all his feelings in the matter from Pacific 1960. Don't end our far-from-finished story on a dying fall, because Coward, with his irrepressible vitality, has bounced back again to explore a brand new field for him. At the suggestion of Anton Dola, he has written London Morning, his first ballet. There's a new play up his sleeve, and he's been busy filming his part in Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana. And that, so far as our story can go, is that. You tried to tell in 60 minutes a tale that could take as many weeks. The tale of the man who lives for and loves the theatre and who remains, rising 60, almost naive in his own bouncing delight at possessing that rare gift, star quality. He has it uniquely and variously. There can be no doubt there are still many good things to come and that probably for many a spring to come here in Britain...
Never spring, my name, my head, between. But what a And so ends this recording of the Noel Coward story, written and narrated by C. Gordon Glover. Among those taking part were Alan Dent and Norman Hackforth, with the recorded voice of the late Stephen Williams, together with the George Mitchell Singers and the BBC Variety Orchestra, leader John Jezzard, conductor Paul Fennelly. The Noel Coward story was edited and produced by Michael North.